Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Howard Wooldridge. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, also known as LEAP, and we had him on the program in May 2005 when he was riding his horse from Los Angeles to New York, and he stopped with his horse Misty right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company. Welcome, Howard.
Good to be with you.
So the mission of LEAP is, as it stated, to reduce the multitude of unintended harmful consequences resulting from fighting the war on drugs and to lessen the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction by ultimately ending drug prohibition. Let's start with the so-called war on drugs. How did that get started in the first place?
Well, the war on drugs was the slogan introduced by President Nixon back in 1971 as the strategy to make prohibition effective. He believed that if you put enough people in jail, you would eventually dry up the sources of the these prohibited drugs and that no drug dealers left, and that we would then have a magical drug-free America. That was 1971 and $1 trillion ago.
Now, the prohibition of drugs, as you call it, and you're making a connection with the prohibition of alcohol, that goes back further than that. Goes back nearly 100 years.
Right. The first prohibition in America, besides the very, very early ones, local ones like in San Francisco with the opium dens and Chinese couldn't smoke opium, other than those local type laws, the first serious prohibition laws started in 1914 with the Harrison Narcotic Act. And also in 1914, Utah became the first state to prohibit the possession and use of marijuana.
And so you were a police officer in Michigan for 18 years. To what extent was your work going after drug dealers and drug users?
Well, I never was involved with drug dealers, not being in narcotics specifically. Once in a while, I'd stop a car, might have a pound of marijuana, which would obviously be a dealer, a small-time retail dealer. But my experience as a police officer was mostly formed when I was a detective for 3 years, and I was arresting people who were addicted, at that time mostly to crack, and they were breaking into one or two houses every day to make the $200 they needed to feed their habit. And in this fashion, I learned that, and also talking to my colleagues across America, a solid 70-75% of all felony crime in this country touches some aspect of prohibition.
So let's talk about that in some more detail. The crime in the cases like you're talking about are not the taking of the drug, nor the buying or nor selling of it. It's the burglary, theft, robbery, et cetera, that is committed in order to feed the habit.
Right. It's a fairly rare occurrence for a person to use these illegal drugs, and because of their use, commit a crime, a violent crime or whatever else. It is the prohibition which drives the cost up so high that to maintain an addiction, unless you're a millionaire like Rush Limbaugh, you have to basically become a criminal, whether a prostitute, break into a house, write bad checks, shoplift, etc., to afford a $100 to $200 a day habit. And there is where the crime comes in that so dramatically affects the quality of life by lowering it all across America.
You, as a police officer, so you weren't working specifically in the narcotics department, but how are police officers trained to be part of the war on drugs? How were you trained? How were others trained? And how are they not only trained as police officers to do what they do, law enforcement, but also to understand the problem?
Well, we're trained in the academy to recognize illegal narcotics. We are also, I remember back in the 80s when the civil asset forfeiture came into effect, that we were said, look, you don't even need drugs in the car anymore to take a citizen's property. You can just find, say, a drug paraphernalia or simply money. And we started seizing cars all across the country in this effort to deny the profits of the drug dealers. But, yeah, all police officers are trained at the academy and then further training once they're on the road to understand where they hide narcotics, etc.
And are they, in other words, one of the problems I think that you have really noticed is that the law enforcement doesn't really work. In other words, you can get rid of a drug dealer, but another one just comes to take their place.
Yes, this is the great silence that my profession is not telling the American people. I've been doing this for 12 years. I have never seen in print an active duty police officer or chief of police or narcotics officer tell the public that the recent bust of 12 guys and, you know, they found 6 pounds of cocaine, whatever, is essentially meaningless because these drug dealers are replaced within a few days to at the most a week. This is true of street-level dealers or guys like Pablo Escobar, who ran the Medellin cartel back 15 years ago. As soon as he was killed, he was replaced immediately. But we don't tell the public that because that would then beg the question, so what's the use, what's the efficacy of arresting a drug dealer? And, of course, the answer is there isn't any. And the reason we don't say anything, one of the big reasons is, of course, taxpayers give us some $70 billion every year to go chase the people who supply Willie Nelson, Rush Limbaugh, and Whitney Houston.
So there is a, what would you say, conspiracy of silence?
I would say there's a conspiracy of silence. We also will tell the public, and it's in fact, I was just at the DEA, you know, the Drug Enforcement Administration's website. They say drugs, guns, and violence go together. Everybody knows this. This is, again, a complete distortion of the picture. It's drug trade and guns and violence go together, the same as in the 1920s with Al Capone and machine gunning people on the sidewalks and in the speakeasies and warehouses. It's not that people got drunk in the 1920s and decided to kill people. It was a straightforward business decision. We see this now terribly, terribly true in Mexico. Hundreds of police officers have been killed this year, thousands of innocent people slaughtered on street corners and in homes across Mexico as the Calderon government has tried to stop the Mexican drug cartels. This has nothing to do with drug use. It has all to do with drug trade. So agencies like the DEA simply distort, essentially lie to the American public in order to maintain their employment.
I mean, maintaining your employment is certainly a motivation for people, but also doing your job in a way that's effective is a motivation for people. And there must be many people in the DEA, for example, who see things the way that you do.
Oh, I've talked to some DEA agents, both active duty and retired, and back at the coffee shop, they all know that they are a mosquito on the butt of an elephant. They know that every kilo of cocaine that they seize means that 10 got through. Every time they bust up a medical marijuana garden or a regular marijuana patch out in California, there's another 15 or 20 they never find. They know how meaningless what they do. They know how meaningless it is what they do. However, they're not going to say that in public because it would be career suicide.
Are there any within the agencies that exist that you've seen effective strategies for dealing with the drug problem?
Well, certainly law enforcement has been completely ineffective over the past 37 years as we spent $1 trillion tax dollars and we arrested 39 million people on drug charges because drugs, after all that effort, are cheaper, stronger and more available to our children today than they were 37 years ago. And this is from information from the federal government, not my opinion. So we know that what we do is completely meaningless on whether drug use goes up or down. But again, if we tell the American public that, then they'll cut off that $70 billion in funding, and of course they like that extra money, the overtime, etc.
We're talking to Howard Wooldridge with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP. So the drug trade is a massive international business, and you're essentially proposing, by ending the prohibition of drugs, by legalizing drugs, a different business model in which drugs are regulated in ways, what, perhaps similar to alcohol and cigarettes. What would this look like?
Well, as a starting point for discussion, I would give these drugs, and many are dangerous, some will kill you, the roughly the same rules, regulations, and restrictions as we give alcohol and tobacco in this country. And I personally would simply establish a state-run ABC-type store that they have in some states for liquor and sell them at, you know, limit their points of sale like they do with alcohol. And in this fashion, we would eliminate every street-level drug dealer in America, besides dropping our felony crime rate by half. I mean, when the important thing for people to do on this issue or any issue is draw up on one side of a piece of paper all the advantages of prohibition as a drug control strategy and all the disadvantages of prohibition as a drug control strategy. And I've done this many, many times with many people. The only thing on the advantage side is, well, maybe drug use would go up, perhaps, if you put cocaine next to tequila in a state ABC store. The disadvantages of are well known to every citizen in America.
And the reason that you say that drug use may go up is because, for example, alcohol use did go down under prohibition. Under alcohol prohibition.
It did go down. However, by the end of prohibition, what I've read, we were drinking almost as much as we were in 1919. And, for example, New York had 15,000 saloons in 1919. By 1933, they had 32,000 speakeasies. And women who had almost never drunk alcohol before prohibition, by 1933, women were drinking almost in the same numbers as men because it was the rebellious and cool thing to do. So women started drinking right along with their boyfriends. And at the end of the day, our grandparents said, look, we can't get rid of alcohol, but we can get rid of all the violence and corruption and chaos created by having Al Capones be in charge of our alcohol supply. And so they were wise enough in 1933 to end it.
So what happened to those alcohol rum-running networks that were there after Prohibition? Where did those people go? I mean, they're people with a specific set of skills, which aren't maybe that wonderful skills or whatever. What happened to them?
Well, a lot of them were actually part-time. I mean, I've seen programs from Prohibition where, say, a guy was running a fishing trawler off the coast of Massachusetts. Well, once in a while, he'd go up to Nova Scotia, pick up a couple thousand bottles of rum or Canadian whiskey and come back down and offload it onto another ship and get into the harbor. So these guys went back to just being fishermen. A lot of drug dealers are part-time. They have other jobs, and they do drug sales part-time. The serious ones will, of course, they'll all be out of business. And if they continue being a criminal, say they start robbing banks like Bonnie and Clyde, then we will capture them or kill them as they choose. But either way, no one will be coming up to take the place of a Bonnie and Clyde in terms of because there's a job opening. That's the great thing that Americans need to realize, is that we can have a world free of drug dealers if we simply have the courage to do what our grandparents did in 1933.
I mean, I think that's something that really takes some emphasizing, is that what you're proposing is getting rid of a business and having a government-sponsored business? I mean, who would?
No, just think of how we you know, there's about, what, I don't smoke cigarettes, but there's, what, 20, 30 major brands of cigarettes. There's 100 brands of whiskey, vodka, tequila, gin, et cetera. And I'm a capitalist. I would let the free market determine what the people would like to buy in terms of these 10 drugs, and then simply provide those citizens with the legal ability to buy those drugs in a safe manner. These drugs would be checked by the FDA and make sure there's no rat poison or something inside of it. And in this fashion, we would have a tremendous drop in overdose deaths because people would know the exact purity and strength of each drug they buy. And in this fashion, we can reduce dramatically the death and disease portions of the current paradigm.
When you talk about this type of regulation of drugs, what about treatment for people who actually want treatment for their drug addiction?
Well, of course, the treatment is, of course, an essential part of all of this. As we have, we have AA for alcoholics, we have Gamblers Anonymous, we have programs out there for treatment once you do get into trouble. And, of course, this would continue into the post-prohibition world. And, in fact, the taxes, if we taxed these illegal drugs today at about a dollar a dose, governments could bring in roughly $10 billion, that's B-boy billion dollars a year. And from that money, they can pay for every person in America who would like treatment for their drug addiction. The good news is, however, that there's actually only a small minority of people who take drugs. that actually become addicted. The government, again, is always showing you all the terrible pictures and statistics of somebody who hurts themselves or dies from, you know, name the drug, meth or cocaine or crack. But the reality is, when you talk to this, you listen. When you listen to the actual medical science, like I do here in Washington, D.C. now, even the government's own director of drug abuse programs has admitted that only 5 to 6% of people who begin using cocaine will, within 2 years, develop an abusive relationship. Meaning, again, the abuse rates and addiction rates for cocaine are about the same as alcohol.
What about methamphetamine and heroin?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all these drugs are dangerous. In fact, that's one of the reasons that we say these drugs are so dangerous, they should be controlled and regulated by the government as opposed to the criminal gangs. But let's take meth. That's the big – I always have meth thrown in my face at many of the congressional and Senate offices I go to. And I say, well, what about meth? I say, look, if American adults had access to the same amphetamines we give to Air Force and Navy pilots to go on these long missions, we would eliminate every meth lab in America, every meth dealer. Now, why would that be such a bad thing?
I guess what I was asking you.
Adults cannot access the amphetamines we give Air Force and Navy pilots. They have to go into the black market, and this causes a great deal of violence and death and of course, crime.
I guess what I was asking was about the addictive nature of methamphetamine as opposed to cocaine.
Right. Well, you know, amphetamines, like the ones Elvis Presley took for your older listeners. But as I say, the Air Force pilots, these have addictive properties, and you can become addicted to store-bought, government-issued amphetamines. However, the addiction rate is much, much lower because of the psychotropic effects of the drugs between methamphetamine and store-bought regular amphetamines. And very few people actually want meth. A lot of people take meth to stay awake. If you're working 7-12-hour days on an oil rig out in Colorado, or you're a waitress who's putting in 7-12-hour days to, you know, feed your family, they could take a 5-milligram pill like we give our Air Force pilots. As I say, you would eliminate the meth problem in America.
I think one of the questions that really is not discussed enough is why people take drugs in the first place. And you were mm-hmm. Just touching on that with the question of methamphetamine. But when you look at what's going on in America and you look at the amount of depression that people have, the lack of a social safety net, the, mm-hmm. you know, people doing 3-4 jobs, and much more, it really does begin to answer questions or at least bring up a real discussion about why people are taking drugs. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I'm not an expert in this issue. I know a little bit about police work and a little bit about how to ride a horse a long ways in a straight line. However, I have talked to doctors about this, and it's not scientific. People take drugs because it makes them feel better or it achieves a purpose. In other words, a lot of us take coffee in the morning because the caffeine revs up your system and it makes you feel more alert, which is what you want to be before you go out the door. People drink a couple beers or a couple glasses of wine in the evening to relax, to wind down from the day and not feel all wired up from all the stress of daily life. As they say, some people take Air Force pilots take amphetamines because the purpose is make sure they stay awake and alert while they're flying a $100 million military aircraft. People take heroin because either one, they're incredibly stupid, or secondly, heroin will give you a 4-hour trip, which is the closest you can get to heaven on earth in terms of no pain, no strain, no worries. You'll be, you know, at peace with yourself. I mean, people have known this for over 100 years, that's what heroin will do. They've also known for 100 years that it's terribly psychologically addictive in the beginning and then, of course, physically addicting, and that's why even 100 years ago, when you could buy heroin out of the Sears catalog, very few people in America would take heroin. And in fact, when the greatest act, the greatest law that ever reduced drug abuse in America was the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, Bayer, the company, produced heroin until 1930, and they put in their aspirin in America until 1906, 1907. When they listed the ingredient of heroin on the outside of their aspirin, people in America 100 years ago stopped buying it because they knew that heroin was a terribly addictive product. And you've also, of course, heard the thing about Coca-Cola used to contain cocaine. And I just saw an advertisement in a museum of drugs that said, feeling tired, drink Coca-Cola. Well, guess what? Cocaine will rev you up way more than coffee. So, again, people take drugs either to feel good or feel the way they want to, or there's a purpose like staying awake.
Is the cocaine and Coca-Cola thing true? I wasn't sure if that was an urban legend.
It is absolutely true. I mean, reams of information on that in terms of in the historical archives, in the histories. As I say, you could buy heroin out of the Sears catalog until 1914.
We're talking to Howard Wooldridge with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, also known as LEAP. So all of this has, if drugs were legalized and regulated, if prohibition on drugs in the United States were ended, that would have massive foreign policy ramifications. What would happen, for example, to the Mexican drug cartels?
Oh, but yeah, another unintended consequence of this. Of course, the Mexican government of Calderon decided 2 years ago to try to stop the drug cartels, who are making somewhere in the area of $10 billion a year off this, and now they're in a massive civil war with 5,000 dead this year, of which about 500 are police officers. They're having people, the six states on our southern border are in a state of semi-anarchy. Police officers are not responding to normal calls for service because they're afraid of being shot dead by the cartels. They've sent in the federal troops and the federales, but these guys are also being corrupted by the massive amounts of money the cartels can give to these federal officers and police and federal troops to look the other way. And so Mexico is is a mess. And this is what used to be, of course, in Colombia 15 years ago, where the cartels were corrupting the government. We now have left-leaning governments in Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, Venezuela, in part because of the drug trade. This is, of course, and worse than that, I read a report in the Army War College earlier this year. 7 out of 10 bullets used by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan are bought with drug money. I mean, this policy is absolutely funding the mortal enemies who attacked us on 9/11 and are continuing to find ways to attack us today. This has been a complete disaster in terms of foreign policy also.
You said a moment ago that there's a connection between left-wing governments and the drug trade. What is that in South and Central America? What's that connection?
Well, Bolivia is a classic example. The DEA went down there and tried to stop the Bolivian cocaleros, the farmers who grew coca, from planting. And so they so upset the majority population down there that 2 years ago they elected a guy who was a cocalero, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he is a left-leaning socialist whose campaign promise was to kick out the Americans and take back control of their country from the DEA, basically, and the United States government, and he was elected. And you have the same thing today. We're being kicked out of an Air Force base in, I think it's Ecuador or Peru, that used to be doing all these flights over the coca-growing areas, which was made famous about 7 years ago when they directed the Peruvian Air Force to shoot down a missionary plane which killed the woman and her little baby.
And we're talking about Evo Morales in Bolivia, and
right.
And Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador are all places where there is a culture of coca being used in a medicinal manner.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not an expert, but I've talked to people from the region. You know, tourists will chew on the coca leaf because it really does help with the being up there at 9, 10, 12,000 feet. And then in talking to residents, if you go back down to the coastal areas, very few people use coca because you don't need it.
So how would policing change? How would law enforcement change if drug prohibition were ended?
Well, we would take a role here in making sure that the state's rules and regulations are adhered to. As a police officer, I ran a sting on our 7-Elevens and convenience stores, and the first time I did it, we had four convenience stores in my township, and I sent a 17-year-old kid with a high school letterman jacket on with $5 and said, "See if you can go buy some beer." And three times out of four, he did. So I walked right in after that and said, "Who sold you the beer?" And he pointed out the person, and I gave that person a ticket, and I then wrote up a report, and the convenience stores were losing their licenses. They had to pay big fines, and guess what they stopped doing? Serving minors. And that's the type of role we will have in a post-prohibition world. Well, we will go into these stores and have people that are 17, 18, 19, and pose as a customer and see if they can buy cocaine or tequila in this type of state ABC store. We will certainly take that type of role to enforce government rules and regulations. Today, there are no regulations to enforce. It's just straightforward prohibition.
I think it's important to point out, as one of your colleagues in LEAP has done, that legalization is a response to crime and violence, not necessarily to the drug problem itself.
Oh, exactly right. Ending prohibition has nothing to do with drugs. It will not change the drug issue at all, in my opinion. It has all to do with stopping the crime and violence, the chaos, the corruption that has been developed as we sell these dangerous drugs off street corners and private homes. And I would point out that, you know, what you asked a little bit ago about, you know, will drug use go up? You know, there has been, what's interesting is there has been no scientific research, no congressional hearings anywhere in the world on whether drug use will go up, down, or stay the same if adults had access to it in a state-regulated store. I've been asking every congressional office, every Senate office now for going on to 3 years, would you please hold a hearing, light a candle, because the American people want to know that answer. Because that is the last reason people give me that I'm afraid to change it, because what if people start using tremendous amounts of cocaine and heroin and marijuana? This would be a problem for America, and they're scared, and nobody can give them an answer because nobody has taken the time to have an official hearing, no doctoral thesis. There is no information on this.
There is an interesting tidbit of information, namely that about 100 years ago, the rate of drug addiction in the United States was 1.3%, and that has remained remarkably steady.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, in a sense...
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons, and when we started the war on drugs by Mr. Nixon, it was about 1.4, 1.3, and today it's still about 1.3, 1.4. In other words, there are certain types of people that gravitate to drugs other than alcohol, Prozac, Valium, etc., and these people were there 100 years ago, and they're still here today, whether it was legal or not. That has not been a deterrent or a changing of the factor. But I can tell you and your listeners that I have talked to 8 doctors across America, board certified in addiction psychiatry. All 8 of them said they believe that drug use will simply bounce. A few people might try it, a few people won't try it, as you lose the glamour effect of something being illegal and the forbidden fruit type concept.
Do we have examples? Well, for example, Holland, there's drugs are a lot more legal. I'm not sure what drugs are legal and illegal in Holland, but there's a lot of legalization of drugs, and there's places where people go to smoke pot or hash or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a model that we should look to?
It's an indicator. Holland made it quasi-legal to sell marijuana out of their coffee shops 32 years ago. The Dutch officials point out that Dutch youth, that's 15 to 29, smoke half as much as American youth of the same age group. Their analysis is because they made it legal, they made it boring. And then so Dutch youth just don't smoke as much as they do here in America. Another place to look for in terms of information is since about 1990, it has been legal to use and possess marijuana as an adult in the state of Alaska. And at least till now, I have never heard any reports that Alaska has gone to hell and ruin because you can legally smoke and use marijuana in that state. And then the last but not least, in the 13 states that the medicinal use of marijuana is legal at the state level, although the Chicken Little said drug use or marijuana use will go way, way up when you send the wrong message, these Chicken Littles were wrong. In all of the states that have medical marijuana, use of marijuana by teenagers has actually gone down about 1% over the last 10 years. So that's the anecdotal evidence we have. But I certainly would love to have a panel of six doctors testify before the Senate this year or next year.
We're talking to Howard Wooldridge with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I think there's also some real horrifying stories about, for example, people with cancer who've been prosecuted for using medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I say don't get me started, but I guess that's not an option. Yeah, the sad part is that God's medicine is nearly perfect. It's highly effective. It has low addiction properties. It has the cost can be basically free if you grow it outside in the backyard, and they say highly effective. So it's a tragedy that people cannot choose this medicine as opposed to what the store-bought medicines are. I just saw a thing in the DEA website say, well, you know, you can take an aspirin for a lot of things or you know, some other painkillers for what marijuana does for you, and that's true. The problem is, ask any competent doctor, when you put enough aspirin and ibuprofen and all these other drugs through your liver and your soft tissues, you can knock a hole. You can destroy your liver. You can destroy your soft tissues and actually die from a long-term misuse of aspirin and ibuprofen. So the beauty of marijuana is it doesn't go through your liver. And with the new methods of using a vaporizer, which means you never even smoke anything, there's no issues of smoke. It's a perfect delivery system. It's just a tragedy that Americans don't have the access there. And my analysis shows, as does others, that the reason medical marijuana stays illegal at the federal level is because the pharmaceutical companies, your friendly drug companies who want to sell you all these pills, they fight me in Capitol Hill tooth and nail because they know that we're talking billions and billions of dollars in lost sales of their pills if people had full access to God's medicine, cannabis.
There's another issue that I think is very important to discuss, and that is the privatization of prisons and the lobbying by the corporations that own the prisons to have mm-hmm. mandatory minimum prison sentences. At this point, it seems like you're getting very far away, like the pharmaceutical issue, from a practical analysis of what's the right thing to do and what's the just thing to do.
Oh, absolutely. Again, another one of my opposition enemies, if you will, on Capitol Hill is the private industries who run these jails and prisons and offer these, in a sense, teaser costs to state legislators. Say, you would have to put up, you know, it costs about $100 million to build a prison, but we'll pay all of that up front, won't cost you a dime. You just give us 1,000 prisoners guaranteed for the next 10 years, and it only costs you $112 a day, and so you'll come out way ahead. And this is, and they also not only try to entice these state legislatures into adopting their idea in Capitol Hill, they're the first ones to fight for more mandatory minimums because that's good for their stockholders.
And so what you basically have is, in that example, is corporations and government colluding to have crime.
Absolutely. That's the correct analysis. Everybody knows, all the police officers in this country know, all the detectives know, that the war on drugs, prohibition, is a huge generator of crime. And to know for no gain. And the other sad part of it is, as I listened to testimony earlier this year with Senator Biden's committee, we have hundreds of thousands of little boys and girls today in a home of a sexually abusive parent where they've used them for child cyber pornography that are still in those homes because we arrested 1.4 million people this year, roughly, for simple possession of drugs, and only about 12,000 to 15,000 people for possession of child cyber pornography, even though we've identified 600,000 people in this country who possess that type of felony child pornography. Because our priorities are completely out of kilter towards the drug war and prohibition as opposed to protecting our children. As a detective who arrested child molesters, this makes my blood boil.
There was a video on your website that I was watching, and the website, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is leap.cc. And the video was about no-knock police raids, basically police raids where they batter down your door without knocking.
Right.
What are these used for? What's going on with that? How common are they?
Well, they're used every day across America as the SWAT teams go in. The concept is that, well, if you don't go through the door in a hurry, then the occupants can flush the drugs down the toilet or some other type of method. And the tragedy is a lot of times you don't need these things. Dallas Police Department, for 10 years, in talking to a lieutenant down there, for 10 years did not do no-knock warrants because they would make their cases on the street. They would have all the narcotics they need already in the police lockup, and then they would simply go to the door, knock on it, say, "You got 2 minutes to come out." Well, in those 2 minutes, the bad guys were flushing drugs down the toilet, but it didn't matter because the case, the drugs that they needed for the case for the jury were already back at the police headquarters. And in this fashion, for over 10 years, they had nobody getting killed, neither police officers nor occupants of the room of the house, because they were simply knocking and waiting 2 minutes for them to do their own thing before the guy came out. It was a wonderful system. This dynamic entry thing is just another poor police tactic to try to catch one more drug dealer with one extra kilo of cocaine. They should make these cases like Dallas did outside the home, have their case all set to go, and not have these dynamic entries. The tragedies like the 92-year-old grandmother killed in Atlanta, the mother holding her baby in Lima, Ohio this year, they go on and on. Here in Washington, we had the mayor had his two dogs shot for no reason, and nobody ever apologized. The list goes on and on. It's another tragedy.
When you were riding your horse Misty across the country and you were stopping in places like the Santa Fe Baking Company and so on, you were talking to people in Elks Lodges and Eagles Lodges and John Birch Society chapters and so on. These are in general very conservative groups. How did they respond to your message, and how are they continuing to respond to it in the years that you've been doing this?
You know, the interesting thing is I start out especially with the conservative groups with, I think there should be six principles to guide drug use in America by adults. And they are individual freedom, personal responsibility, property rights, as it's your body, limited government, cost-effective government, and states' rights. And when I start out my program saying those six things, they say, wait a minute, this guy's a conservative. And on this particular issue, I am very conservative. I believe in those six principles. And by the way, those are the six principles, as you know, that we give to the first and second deadliest drugs in America, alcohol and tobacco. And so when these conservatives hear that, they go, wait a minute. If he's calling for the end of prohibition to legalize and regulate these drugs using those six principles, and those are conservative, then if I believe in prohibition, what does that make me? And I've had many, many dozens of people across America all of a sudden look at themselves in a sense in the mirror and go, wait a minute, I'm supporting essentially a liberal policy where we threaten citizens with government punishment backed by government police and prosecutors for them to stay inside the box of alcohol, tobacco, Prozac, and Valium. And I've had many hundreds of listeners and my audiences across the country realize that current policy is basically a concept of the nanny state protecting you from your own stupidity. And as my wife said, my new wife says, the state, through its police department, cannot stop personal stupidity. And so many conservatives, after they hear my message, understand that if they want to be truly conservative, they have to support the end of the war on drugs.
I guess it's more like a libertarian conservatism that you're talking about.
Sure, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party are the only two in America who have embraced the concept of ending a drug prohibition and allow the citizen to be basically as stupid as they want to be in the privacy of their own home as an adult.
It's interesting because I think that one of the things that happened in the 60s 60s and 70s, I guess, in the cultural movements in America was people started to use drugs to expand their minds, and they said, gee, isn't this great? And the conservative response to that was not just so much that, oh, this is dangerous and people are getting addicted, but these people are forming a new culture and they're having fun and they're not doing things the way we did them, and that in itself was threatening. And I think that's a different kind of conservatism.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I'm 57, so I lived through the anti-war period of the 60s and into the 70s. And Nixon, as the icon and the leader of that particular type of thinking, sincerely believed that marijuana was the destroyer of the American culture of America, and that's why when he declared his war on drugs, it was a war on marijuana. The DEA. Continued to focus on marijuana even to the late 70s and early 80s, even as cocaine took off across America, they were still focusing on marijuana because their tradition from the very beginning was that marijuana was the true threat to American culture. Of course, the irony is now all those kids like me in college in the 60s and 70s all grew up, and now we're becoming the president. The last two and the future president have all used marijuana. And millions, tens of millions of us, almost all of us, after we left college and left the marijuana, the cocaine behind, we've gone on to have successful careers as, say, doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. And the tragedy is the unlucky few who got caught have just been hurt badly by the stigma of that arrest for, pot possession or whatever else from their youth. This is really, really, especially in this new times of economic troubles, this is really an economic break on our country that we need to lift as soon as possible.
We're talking to Howard Wooldridge with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So, I mean, when you were talking to all these people, people in conservative groups and religious groups, too, did they change their minds?
Well, actually, a lot of them did, or they walked away saying, I'm not quite sure what to think, but you certainly gave me lots of food for thought. Now, the religious groups, that's a little bit different, in a sense, a little bit harder nut to crack. But it's the same thing applies here, because as one minister pointed out in Alabama on a radio show, he says, look, it's not just your body. It's the body that God gave you, and you should not be putting drugs in your system. And I said, sir, I agree with you 100%, but by the same token, in your congregation, do you have people who smoke cigarettes? He said, yes. I said, should we take, and cigarettes are not good for the body God gave you, correct? And he said, yes. I said, would you think that you would send a message to your elected officials that people should be put in jail for smoking cigarettes because it's harming the body that God gave them? Long pause on the air. He says, well, no. I said, what about the people in your congregation that are overweight? And they're obese, and that's hurting their body. They're going to die sooner, leaving their family and their friends and their children. Should people who are obese be put in some type of state lockup until they become skinny enough, to be healthy? Well, no. I said, okay. Well, then, why do you think somebody hurting themselves with using a drug like, say, marijuana or cocaine or ecstasy should be put in jail? Another long pause. And he says, well, maybe I need to rethink this. So if people just would stop and think about what we're doing and the unintended consequences, as we've discussed in the last 30 minutes, I think they would say, you know what, this prohibition really isn't good for anything.
So now you're in Washington, D.C. You've ridden your horse across the country a couple of times. You've been talking to people in all these, small towns, big towns, cities across America. You've been on the radio and in the newspaper and have done really a wonderful job, and you and many others, in bringing this issue to the American people. Now you're in D.C. You're lobbying. You're talking to legislators. What are you getting back?
Well, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm an education specialist. I work with the tax deductible money, but I've going on my third year now. I present basically what I've talked about here in the radio. I have to condense it down to about 15 or 20 minutes, and just say, we're going to try to make your phone ring so that the congressman or the senator knows it's okay to discuss this as a policy. As you know, there's a thundering silence on this policy. Nobody talked about it in the recent presidential campaign, nor in 2004 or 2000 or 1996. nobody wants to talk about drug policy, even as this is the greatest generator of crime in America. It lowers the quality of life for all of us because we're all potential or actual crime victims, as it destroys and it creates a war zone in our inner cities and our barrios, giving our children employment opportunities, which gets them killed or sucked into a gang. Everybody knows the unintended negative consequences of this dysfunctional, destructive, immoral policy. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to start a discussion or a dialogue on whether we should continue this new prohibition. And my great challenge in D.C. and for all of us in LEAP is to start this national discussion. Should we continue prohibition or not? And the trouble is, the politicians, as you know, very few of them are leaders. Most of them are followers, and they are scared to death of upsetting one voter. The only true exception to that right now is Senator Jim Webb, the Democrat from Virginia. He's already held three hearings on this issue of 2.3 million Americans in jail. How bad is that for America? So he is investigating. He is lighting a candle, and I certainly support his efforts.
Is there any palpable difference between Democrats and Republicans when you speak to them?
Well, with Democrats, there's more sympathy for the gross abuse of what's going on today, where you have the massive disparity between the people of color being arrested and Caucasians being arrested. Everybody's aware of that, and Democrats are more sympathetic, saying, you know, we need a kinder, gentler, more even-handed drug war. But even very few Democrats, extremely few Democrats, will come out and say the whole prohibition approach is bad and we should end it. In fact, in Congress, not one has done that. There's been basically, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has said she would end cannabis prohibition immediately and then work on the others. And then we have two Republicans who have said that we need to end all federal prohibition, but it's tiny.
And so you're really fighting a kind of Sisyphean battle. I mean, do you see any movement at all?
Oh, sure. I've seen in the 3 years I've been doing this now, at the staff level, there is ever less, to the point of almost no resistance to the LEAP message that we would be better off as a nation on every level if we ended prohibition. When I first got here, I had people getting mad at me and just calling me crazy and a few bad things. And, you know, if we just shot every drug dealer, we'd be fine. The aide of a famous senator, whose name you would know in a heartbeat, said that to me a few months ago. But generally speaking now, the aides get it, they understand it, and I believe there will be serious progress, unfortunately, because as we go into, the states go into economic crisis and there's no money, they are looking at in 2009, I just spoke to my state senator here in Maryland yesterday, had a 30-minute sit-down. Maryland, like many states, are looking at, are we going to close some prisons, some junior colleges, or some hospitals? Those are your choices for the voters in 2009, and it'll be incumbent upon your listeners to say to their elected officials there in Santa Fe and New Mexico in general that please close the colleges, close the prisons, let out the people who sold small amounts of narcotics. Keep your doctors working. Keep your professors working. That's what's good for New Mexico and the country.
So what kind of a movement is there, a citizen movement, and how does it work? I mean, are people supposed to call their mayor, state representatives, or what?
Well, I urge all of your listeners to call your state senator, your state rep, write an email to the governor, and say, when the budget crunch comes, look to states like Michigan, which cut their mandatory minimums in half, let out a lot of prisoners, save lots of money to keep their colleges fully funded. But they need to give these elected officials the courage to understand that where the priorities of their constituents are. If you say nothing, the easy answer for 40 years for politicians is, I'm getting tough on drugs and I'm never going to go back off from that position, because it always got them reelected. If enough citizens say to Governor Richardson, well, I guess he's going to be gone now, but whoever your new governor is or your state senator, you know, please close some prisons, keep the junior colleges open, keep the hospitals open. You know, in New Mexico, you got many rural areas that depend on that hospital. If you close it, that means somebody has to drive an extra 40, 50 miles to an ER. I mean, this will certainly cause people to lose their life. It's already being done in New Jersey. They've closed 6 hospitals there.
Heavens. Well, we're just about out of time. Howard Wooldridge is a retired police officer. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, also known as LEAP, which is on the web at leap.cc. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, taking all this time on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, you're most welcome, Mary Charlene, and I thank you for having me on. And I hope this helps your audience understand the dynamics of this terrible, terrible policy we have.
Indeed. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz features an hour of Artist of the Month, Pepper Adams. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow with Robert Knott. Ciao.